Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Today I'm here with Tim Cheadle, Director of Engineering at Resolve to Save Lives. Tim, welcome to the show.
Hey Jason, it's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show. Do you want to tell us about yourself?
Sure. As you said, I'm with a nonprofit called Resolve to Save Lives, which is an initiative of an organization called Vital Strategies. And what we focus on is cardiovascular health around the world. So we work to find people that are at risk for heart disease and try and make them healthier. And our goal is to save 100 million lives in 30 years.
100 million lives in 30 years. Do you know how many lives you're at so far?
That's a great question, actually. So we have about 250,000 patients that we've registered. And all of those people have hypertension, and most of them are ongoing hypertension treatment. So we can get into the details, but we are at the beginning, or maybe at the 500-meter mark of a marathon, let's say.
Okay, got it. And there's this other organization called Simple.org. Can you tell us about the relationship between Resolve to Save Lives and Simple.org?
Yeah, so Simple is actually an open source application that we made to help us improve heart health around the world. So what it is an extremely lightweight medical record that supports large-scale hypertension treatment programs in places like India, Bangladesh, and soon Ethiopia. So it's an open source Android app and Ruby on Rails backend. So it's not really an organization, it's just an open source piece of software that we support.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, I went to the website and I thought it was like a company, but this is the website for the, I was gonna say product, but product isn't even the right word. You call it an application? Is that the way you refer to it?
No, I think product works. Yeah. Except it's completely open source and it's also completely free as in cost.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, and the reason I brought you on the show, or the thing that triggered me to invite you on the show, is that you're hiring a developer to work on Simple, it sounds like. And so I thought it would be cool if we could just talk about maybe your story as a developer and then what it's like to work on Simple and all that kind of stuff. First of all, I always cyberstalk my guests a little bit before we get on the show. Are you located in Charlotte, North Carolina?
I am.
Yeah, I saw that on your LinkedIn. I've been to the area a number of times, Concord, North Carolina.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Yeah. Okay, so are you just the one person in that area? Is it a distributed team? First, let me ask this. I don't quite understand, like, Simple versus Resolve to Save Lives versus the other thing you mentioned. What are, like, the overlap? Like, who works on what? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a little confusing, even to me, and I've been here 2.5 years. So Vital Strategies is a global nonprofit focused on all things public health. So they focus on road safety and quitting smoking, like tobacco cessation. They focus on maternal health. And Resolve to Save Lives is an initiative inside of Vital Strategies. And Resolve was founded by Dr. Tom Frieden, who used to run the U.S. Centers for Disease Control under President Obama. And when he left, he looked around and said, what can I do to have the most positive impact on the world? And decided to found Resolve to Save Lives, raised a fair amount of money. And our two focuses are preventing epidemics, which, of course, that team is quite busy right now, and cardiovascular health. And that's the side that I work on. So cardiovascular health consists of banning trans fat worldwide, working with governments to do that. Working with food industry to reduce sodium, so reduce the amount of salt that people are eating. And the part that I'm focused on is hypertension treatment. So finding people that have high blood pressure and getting them on medication and getting them to come back to get their blood pressure checked. And in order to do that, you have to record their blood pressure every single month or every time they come into the clinic. And you have to record what medications they're on so that you can proceed through the treatment protocol. And if you do that on paper, it works fine, except it doesn't scale and paper has all sorts of problems. So we thought, you know what, there's a good chance that software can fit here. If we make the software as simple and easy to use and fast as possible, and that's what Simple aims to be.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. And I imagine it's an interesting challenge drawing the line between like, where is technology appropriate versus like, there's always the danger of thinking that technology is this panacea. You might have seen that XKCD comic where it's like, there's the guy, maybe he's even wearing a cape or something, and he's like, oh, I see this problem over here. I know, I'll solve it with algorithms. And then it's like 5 years later, oh, wait, this is actually really hard. So I imagine like the software component can facilitate some things, but it's the real, well, I guess, hopefully it's kind of clear what I'm getting at there. It's probably a tough challenge to like know what the software can help with and what it can. Is that right?
It is. I mean, I'm just sitting over here laughing because all too often, especially in our industry, we have this mindset that software is some sort of silver bullet. And I found that that mindset even persists outside of the tech industry. People view software as this kind of magical thing because they don't know how to make it and they know it is empowering such good in our lives and such growth in our lives. And so they when they get software that they think is going to work for them, they think, oh, this is going to solve all my problems. And of course it never does, right? It never does with simple things like to-do list apps. It never really makes you that much more productive or happy. I mean, it might help a little bit. But then when you're talking about the truly hard problems in the world, especially kind of problems like hypertension, where they exist on a global scale of billions of people. Software is a means to an end, but it's certainly not the end. And what it really takes is lots of people working at the strategy stage, at the tactical stage, boots on the ground, healthcare workers, governments, all working together in concert with software to actually solve the problem. Now, does software play a role? It absolutely does. But that software needs to be built with empathy and built with respect for empowering everybody else to do their jobs better.
Yeah, that's great. And I appreciate that you appreciate that. And I think it's a message that the software industry as a whole needs to hear over and over again. And this is why I don't believe, I'm not afraid of, in the least, of the AI apocalypse, because it's like, we're just not going to be anywhere near there for so incredibly long. Most software is like really dumb, and we're not going to get to an AI apocalypse anytime soon. Totally different topic though. So I want to ask you about like the team who works on Simple. Can you tell me about like the composition of the team? And you said it's Rails and Android. So like, what do you have for people working on the Rails side versus the Android side?
Yeah. So zooming out a little bit, we're actually a little bit of an oddity in the nonprofit and public health world in that Resolve to Save Lives hired an internal software team. Usually you find that these products are kind of outsourced to other agencies or something like that. So that's been a really interesting experience. This is my first time working in nonprofit work and also in healthcare. Our team consists of myself, director of engineering, and Daniel Burka, who's our director of design. And we oversee a team of, I think, 12, 13 people, something like that. And we've primarily hired two firms in India that we work with. One's called Obvious, and both firms are based out of Bangalore. Obvious is our design team, as well as our Android development team. We also work with a company called Nilenso that is, again, in Bangalore, and they are the server/Rails developers. And we also have a lead engineer in Bangalore and another senior Rails developer here in the States.
Got it. You ever go over there to Bangalore?
I have been to India 8 times in 2 years.
Oh,
and
wow.
I miss it. I miss it terribly. I love it there.
Yeah. Yeah. Me and my family went there last January, so about a year and a half ago. It was great. We went to Goa, India. That was where RubyConf India was happening.
And that was, that's cool.
Yeah, that was a great experience. Have you gone there in the summer when it's like super hot?
Oh, I've been all over India at this point, and I've been there when it's super hot and what they call cold, which to me just feels normal.
Yeah. Yeah, it was crazy. Like, we went there, so we went there in January, but it was like, first of all, the weather was insanely consistent. It was like 89 degrees and sunny every single day. It would be like 89, 89, 89, 90, 89, 89 is what the forecast would look like. I didn't know the weather could be so consistent anywhere on earth. I live in Michigan where it's up and down all the time. And in this 90 degree heat, I can't tell you how many people I saw wearing like wool caps and sweatshirts and all these warm clothes. And I'm like, you're like tormenting me by wearing all these warm clothes in the 90 degree heat.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny what you get used to. I mean, I used to live in San Francisco, and even living there, I became a lot more sensitive to weather. So when I would come back east, I would feel the cold a lot more intensely. Now that I've lived on the East Coast again, I'm kind of used to it again.
Oh,
you just get used to it, I guess.
Yeah.
India is a wonderful country, and I'm very fortunate to have been able to travel all over it, and I can't wait to get back.
Yeah. Yeah, I really want to go back. To be honest, it wasn't really on my list of places that I was planning to go to. I just got a conference talk accepted at RubyConf India. But it was great. And I found that the Indian food in India is much different than the Indian food in America, which is, I guess, shouldn't be a huge surprise, but that was one of my favorite parts of it. I got to ride on the back of a motorcycle through the traffic there, which was a harrowing experience.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hear you about the Indian food. I mean, I love Indian food, but what you realize is that there's such diversity in the food there that we just isn't represented in the US. That's one of my favorite parts of going is not only trying all the different food, but I love to cook. And so I like to cook with my friends there and just get a much different experience than what you're going to find here in the States.
Yeah. Yeah. That was really interesting. You always find something that's surprising when you travel somewhere you've never been before.
Yeah.
Okay. So how old is this application? How long have you guys all been working on it?
That's a good question. I'll give you a little bit of the history of it. So I started in February 2018, and we knew that the hypertension treatment programs that we were trying to help had already been started. So they were already having patients come into clinics, taking their blood pressures, and then if they had hypertension, they would write their information down on a piece of paper and ask them to come back once a month. And every time they'd come in, they'd kind of go to the filing cabinet, pull up their piece of paper, hopefully it was still legible, and write down their updated blood pressure and medications. And they were doing this in a handful of clinics in a handful of states across India. And we partner with the World Health Organization and the Indian Council of Medical Research in a program called the Indian Hypertension Control Initiative. I know that's a lot of words, but all that is to say that we're not doing this alone. We're actually partnering with the government of India and the World Health Organization to execute this. So there was already a fair amount of infrastructure in place. And when we got there, we didn't want to say, okay, we're starting from scratch. Let's just tear all this down and build a new thing. What we really did was go to the clinics in the field. And we wanted to see what is a day in the life of a nurse in a rural clinic in India? What is the day in the life of a doctor? What about the people that are overseeing and supervising this program? What kind of reporting are they doing? How are they keeping track of how many drugs are in stock at a certain place or how many patients are being seen? So it was a lot, maybe 2 months of observation. And then we went in with a prototype. We just used, I forgot the software, but you know, a clickable prototype, and did some user studies to see what made sense to users. And I think we launched the app in July of 2018. So it took us about 3-4 months to build the Android app and the basic Ruby on Rails backend. And now we're in, I think, over 1,000 clinics, as I mentioned, 250,000 patients. So we've grown pretty quickly.
You said you're in over 1,000 clinics?
Yep.
Oh, wow. So somebody might hear what you just said and they might think, oh, you're building an EMR, electronic medical record system. To what extent is it that? And to what extent is it not really an EMR, but this other more specialized thing?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. And we get that a lot. I don't know if I could say we are building an EMR or we're not. Often we call it the world's thinnest electronic medical record because we say it does almost nothing on purpose. And the reason for that is simple.
That could be interpreted two ways.
Yeah,
it does
exactly.
Almost nothing on purpose, or it does almost nothing on purpose. Everything it does accidentally. I know which way you're in it. I just was inserting one of my hilarious jokes.
Yeah. So yes, it does almost nothing. And here's why. The problem with most electronic medical records is that they try to record every piece of information you could possibly want to know about a patient, about a visit. And you know, there's this myth that all of that information is useful. But ultimately, if you're recording a piece of information, if you're taking up time with a patient to record a piece of information that no one ever looks at, that's just a waste of time. And when you do that, it makes the user interface and user experience really complicated. Add to that the fact that we're working in places where they don't have 20 minutes with a patient. They average about 4 minutes with a patient. And we consistently heard one message in our user research, we still do to this day, which is, look, I can use your software, just don't make my life harder. My job's already hard, don't make it harder. And the nurses tell us this, the doctors tell us this. And so our app is extremely lightweight. What happens is when you come in and you're a new patient, we record your name, a few details about your address, your phone number, your gender, and we ask a few medical history questions, such as, have you ever had a heart attack? Do you have diabetes? That kind of thing. And then we take a blood pressure and we might write down what medication you were prescribed and we tell you to come back in a month and that's it. It does support, the app does support diabetes now, so we can record blood sugar, random blood sugar, but that's not our focus. Our focus is hypertension. And so it's that basic on purpose, because our goal is to take less than 60 seconds to register a new patient and less than 15 seconds to look up an existing patient.
Okay. And does it do anything to do with scheduling and stuff like that?
Yeah. So when you get your blood pressure and you have high BP, what will often happen is we'll put you on medication, say like amlodipine 5 milligrams, and say, look, take this every day and come back in a month. And if you come back in a month and you still have a high BP, they'll change the medication potentially. But we want to make sure that person comes back. That's really the key to this whole thing working. And so in the app, when you record a BP and you click save, it says, oh, when do you want to see this patient back? And it defaults to a month. But it's not really an appointment. It's not like, oh, they have to come back on June 26th at 1 o'clock. It's just a reminder mostly to the clinic to say, hey, if you haven't seen this person back in a month, you should probably try and follow up with them. So to that end, we also send automated WhatsApp messages. So if you've missed your appointment, 3 days later, we'll remind you over WhatsApp. And then in some cases, the nurses actually call the patients from the app itself. We have a secure calling feature, so the patient can't see the nurse's phone number, kind of like calling an Uber driver. So the nurses can do that. And in some cases, they actually know where the patients live and they can send people to their houses to say, hey, remember to go get your BP checked.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So get patient follow-up. I mean, the key to treating hypertension, it's really basic. The drugs are extremely affordable. I think the medication averages $2 a year per patient. It's extremely low cost. They're very low risk and they work. So the trick is getting somebody to take pills every day for the rest of their life and getting them to come back once a month or so to get their blood pressure checked.
I've read that the rate of people actually taking their medications they're supposed to take is like abysmally low.
I have no doubt. It's really hard. I mean, imagine trying to get your parents to take a medication, even just one pill, every day for the rest of their lives, and then try to do that across 200 million people in India.
Oh, yeah.
It's a hard problem.
Yeah. I am having allergies really bad right now because it's like June, and I've been trying to remember to take Claritin every day. And in the last 2 weeks of intending to take Claritin every single day, I've taken it once. Wait, I think twice. But I'm like having awful allergy systems or awful allergy symptoms, and I know I should take this thing, and it's like right there in the bathroom cupboard thing. Can't manage to do it. So I can definitely understand how like that is a big problem of people staying on top of it.
Especially when you add in the complications of the fact that hypertension typically doesn't have any symptoms. So people think to themselves, well, I feel fine. I don't need to take my medication anymore. Well, of course, you're taking medication so that you feel fine.
Yeah.
And the second thing is a lot of these patients are older and they just forget. So it's really common to have other family members, such as a child or a spouse or something, help people with their medication.
Yeah, that makes sense. So yep. were you there from the very beginning of this app's development?
I was. Yep. So what happened was when Tom was thinking about building out this hypertension treatment initiative, he knew software would have to be involved. He got in touch with Daniel Burko, who's now my design partner, and they ran a design sprint in November 2017. And out of that sprint, they realized two things. One, that this was a possibility, that there was at least some light at the end of the tunnel of how this software might work. And two, that if they outsourced this, it would absolutely fail. It just would be way too expensive. People wouldn't understand the context. Just not only practically, but ethically, the software needed to be built in part by a team in India so that they can understand the context in which it's operating. And so then Daniel convinced me to come work with him, and we both started this together.
Interesting. So how did you go from nothing to getting started and building like the MVP or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, a lot of time. I'm convinced the only way to make good software is to consistently talk to your users. And so we spent a lot of time in the field, traveling all over Punjab, which is the first state we launched in, just getting to know our users. And honestly, that time was an extremely good investment, not only in terms of making the product better, but just finding motivation to build an amazing product for people. I can't tell you how inspiring it was to meet these nurses and midwives and doctors that were so extremely driven to help their communities with very little resources, but a lot in terms of pride and drive and really, honestly, an excellent public health system. The public health system in rural India is arguably better than it is in some parts of America. So
interesting.
They just don't have as many resources. So anyway, spent a lot of time in the field figuring out what to build, because I think a big challenge in software that a lot of developers skip, or we just don't teach our developers to do this, is to really understand the problem. The code is the easy part. I'm not saying code is easy, but it is definitely easier than understanding what to build in the first place. And then
I would agree with that, or I would maybe say it's challenging in a different way.
Yeah. And so then we came back and we kind of found some validation of most of our prototype that we built was on target. There's some things that were confusing to people that we didn't expect, and some things that we thought would be confusing that weren't. And we also drew a lot of inspiration from the fact that mobile phones are so prevalent these days. That's one thing I should mention that's kind of radical about our software, is that it primarily runs on the nurses' personal phones. So it's not, there are some cases where governments have issued devices, but for the most part, we want to run on the nurse's phone. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One, it's low cost to us, obviously. But the bigger reasons are We built our app to be offline first. So it works entirely offline, with a few exceptions around logging in. And then, of course, when you do have network, it will opportunistically sync all the patient data to the server. Mm. If we're going to do that, this opens up a couple of things. One, the nurse is going to keep her own phone updated, keep the software updated. She's going to keep it fixed. If it gets a crack in the screen, you know, or breaks, she'll probably replace it. And third, she's going to be mobile with it. So maybe there's no Wi-Fi or network connectivity at her clinic, but if she walks or takes the bus home along the way, she might have network, right? And it's just this important inflection point in kind of tech progression around the world that cell phones are so prevalent. I mean, these areas, they kind of skipped the desktop and laptop computer age and went right to mobile computing. And I think you're going to see a lot more health apps take advantage of that over time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's kind of interesting regarding the progression of technology. Some countries have like leapfrogged certain parts of the infrastructure. Like in certain parts of Africa, they went straight from not even having phone lines to having mobile phones. And so just they never in their history was phone lines part of it, because they just skipped straight from the really old way to the really new way.
Yeah, and you're seeing some really exciting developments follow that. I mean, like payments tech in Africa is absolutely amazing. It makes the US look absolutely backwards in comparison.
Yeah, it's interesting to see some of the different kinds of startups. Like there was this startup I encountered when I went to RubyConf India. It's like huge, but I had never heard of it because it's really not made for us. It's made for them there. It was called like GoJet or something like that.
Gojek. Yep.
Yeah, I think it might be based in Indonesia, but somewhere in Southeast Asia. And I could tell, I don't remember right now what it does, but I'm reading the Wikipedia right now, or the thing on Google. Gojek was first established in Indonesia in 2009 as a call center to connect consumers to courier delivery as two-wheeled ride-hailing services. It's like, yeah, two-wheeled ride-hailing services, like, not so applicable in the U.S. So this is a startup right. idea that's like very specific to this region of the world.
Yeah, in fact, you see just food delivery and delivery services in general, that kind of gig economy is so much bigger in places like India than I ever imagined.
Interesting.
Certainly bigger than it is here.
Interesting. My other question I wanted to ask you relates to scaling, because I imagine that as you went from nothing to 1,000+ clinics, you encountered some kind of scaling issues in some ways. And I want to say what I mean by scaling, because I'm sure that you know what I mean, but most people, when they say scaling, they probably think in terms of like requests per second and stuff like that. But there's all kinds of other scaling issues. Like in my work, we have very small scale scaling, but when it was just me, just one developer for a long time, and now we have two developers, and we went from the medical clinic that the software runs in, it went from two doctors to three doctors and soon five doctors, and the patient volume increasing the whole time. The scaling includes just things like I'm getting more support requests coming my way to like go into the database and manually fix some error because somebody messed up, and those kind of errors are happening more frequently, and now I have to add more features so that I don't have to do that manual stuff anymore. And just there's more of everything happening. And so it's not just like load on the server type scaling, it's scaling of all times. There's just of all kinds, there's just more stuff in general. So what kind of that kind of stuff have you experienced?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't echo your experience more exactly. And so look, I used to work at Google, and part of the reason I was interested in this job is I was a site reliability engineer at Google. And so scale in terms of kind of requests per second or amount of storage or number of computers, like that doesn't really faze me anymore. But like you said, those aren't really the kinds of scale that we're running into. The scaling issues that we're running into have to do with the fact that not everywhere in India uses the same format of addresses. So you got to build an address format that adapts, so you're not writing one-off software every time. As we went to Bangladesh and now going to Ethiopia, we have to host our Rails app on an entirely different infrastructure. In fact, I just spent the last 2 weeks configuring servers that Ruby and Rails is going to run on bare metal on Ubuntu, and I literally shipped them to Ethiopia because that's how we're getting servers into the country. And so you had this scale issue of needing to adapt to the systems and partners that you're working with. You have a scale issue in terms of support requests. We get the same kind of requests all the time, like, oh, I accidentally wrote a city name into the village field and I need to go fix that. Or I accidentally registered these patients in the wrong clinic. You know, even at the very beginning, we had an issue of, I can't find my patients. Like I typed the patient name in and I can't find them. And I know they're a patient in the system because they have an ID card that I gave them. So those kind of scale issues. To me, software gets really interesting when it solves human problems. I'm not personally all that interested in solving like super technical problems at this point in my career. And human problems are inherently a lot more messy and a lot more diverse. But to me, that makes them so much more fun. And as we continue to grow, we're going to continue to run into these kinds of issues. I mean, just run into different bureaucracy, run into different regulations that we have to match. And then the other factor, frankly, is population in India. As I mentioned, there's maybe 200, 300 million people with hypertension. And so when we launch in a new district, like we're about to launch in Chennai, we'll immediately add another 150,000 patients to our system in a matter of weeks. So
wait, how many?
150,000.
Whoa.
Yeah. And okay. That's small. I mean, you know, we're talking about cities in this country that have 20 million people. So it's just the hockey stick graph here is pretty impressive. And again, it's an offline first app. So it's not scaling in terms of requests per second or anything like that. But it's scaling out to support the constraints that we have to meet. Working on crappy Android devices, working to make sure that we're not taking up too much space on people's personal phones because they want to keep pictures of their kids, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I might invite you for a second episode later just on what it's like to be an SRE at Google. I have the Google SRE book on my shelf behind me because in addition to being the developer where I work, I've been the SRE the whole time and every other technical role because I'm the only guy. But how do you deal with all those issues? Like, it seems to me like if you have 100,000+ patients coming online, then that's going to be a huge spike. And so what do you do to prepare for that? Or is it not so much a spike? Is it just not a big deal, or how does that go?
It's definitely a spike, and we're already running into issues where, since it's offline first, we sync every patient record in a district to every phone in that district. So we're reaching a point where when that was, 10, 20,000 patients on a phone, that's not that big a deal. But when you're talking about 80 to 100,000 patients on a phone, all of a sudden the SQL queries on the phone app start to slow down. Page render times start to slow down. All of a sudden kind of search results pages get longer and longer. So we're taking steps to optimize all those things and also figure out just how can we sync fewer patient records to the phone, but still allow patients to be found when they show up to the clinic. I mean, it's a really tricky, fun problem. And in terms of 150,000 patients, one of the things we haven't talked about is we're actually also going to import their existing patient records. So they've already been under treatment for hypertension. We just want to get their records digitized into Simple. So that involves working with hiring data entry operators, making sure that they've got the legal clearance to view patient data, which is a big deal. Making sure that we don't get errors, making sure that that we give them the tools that use our APIs so we can validate all the data that they're getting in. I mean, it's a big project for sure.
Yeah. Wow. And so do you have to do a custom ETL script or something every time you have to import somebody's patients? Because it can't be that everything is uniform.
No, it's far from it. In fact, that's a good rule of thumb for India, that nothing is uniform. So we do, I call it kind of data concierge work. And this is where it gets tricky. So right now we're at a stage where we actively want to do that kind of work. We want to work with these health systems to get their records into the system. But at some point, we just don't have the team equipped to do that. And so rather than tell them, no, you have to do this yourself, it's really, how do you give them the tools to make this self-service? In fact, one of my long-term goals with Simple is to become more purely a software team. And the people that want to use Simple, it's just like downloading WordPress or something. You can go run it yourself. You don't need the WordPress team to handhold you the whole way. That's easier said than done with healthcare data, of course. We're always going to need... be involved to some extent, but you asked about an ETL. I mean, if you want to call putting data in a spreadsheet and importing it an ETL, then yes, that's what we're doing. but you know, we're trying to make it as straightforward for them as possible, but also as little one-off effort for our engineering team, because you know, the more time my developers spend importing data, the less time they are spending adding features and fixing the system. So
yeah. And to go back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, how do you handle those cases where somebody puts something in the wrong field and it needs to be manually fixed? Do you have a portion of your team who's dedicated to that kind of stuff, or how do you manage that?
No, we don't. I mean, sometimes we'll help, because sometimes, frankly, it's just easier for a developer to go into a Rails console and fix things. But what we really try and do is, when we run into those situations, that's a sign that our app has failed, that somehow they've seen fit to put the wrong data in the wrong place. And really, that's our fault. It's almost never the user's fault. I don't like that mentality at all. And so we just need to make our app better. Maybe we need to give them the tools in the app to clean up their own data.
Yeah.
Because
Sorry, I want to add to that, because like, not only it's not like that's just a bad attitude to have, that it's the user's fault. It's often factually incorrect. Like I talked about this in the last episode I recorded on this podcast with Chelsea Troy. We talked about usability testing. And I didn't mention this on the previous episode, but when I first started getting into usability testing, and even before, I would have a scenario where I would show my work to a user. They would try to use the software to carry out what they needed to do, and they would make some mistake. And I'd be like, well, that person was dumb. They like did it wrong. I blame them. And then I would show it to second person. They would make the same exact mistake. And then third person, same mistake, so on. Like several people stumbled on the same part of the UI, and I would realize, oh wait, it's not that all these people were dumb in the same exact way, it's that this design just sucks, and that place that everybody stubbed their toe on, that's a sign that that part of the design needs to be fixed.
Yep. So you run into that. I mean, all of us developers have seen that, and it's fair to have that visceral reaction of, oh man, I wish they would just understand the software better. But again, that's just a sign that you need to do better. I just think we do a poor job of recognizing that the software exists to empower human beings, not the other way around. I mean, you see this all the time where you have to adapt to the tool instead of the tool adapting to you. You know, my classic example of poor usability is something that asks you to type in your phone number without dashes. It's like, everyone types their phone number. You just take them out. You're a computer.
You're a computer, exactly.
And you just see this constantly. I call it design by developers. And it's not to disparage developers, but look, we're not the best designers in the world. And we have this tendency to make the UI really just an interface to the database instead of making it empathetic and really understanding what the user is trying to do. And I just think we need to do a better job of that. I hope that at Simple, that's something we really focus on. In fact, we constantly do user studies to help us improve in those ways.
Yeah. And if somebody's listening and they think, man, I know that my design skills are weak, how do I get better at this? My suggestion would be to learn usability testing, because I don't know if that's the one and only answer, but for me, when I learned usability testing, it was like a night and day difference, and it made the hugest difference in my ability to design interfaces that actually made sense to the people who were using them.
Yeah, I mean, even just the basics of usability testing, like when you go put your software in front of people, you don't tell them like, oh, hey, look at this cool thing that I built. What do you think? Because that's such a loaded question and they don't want to disappoint and you won't get honest feedback.
And they'll just say, oh, it's good.
Yeah, right. And the other thing that I would encourage developers to do before usability testing is talk to your users before you build something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And get to know what their needs are before you ever invest in software, because maybe the answer isn't software at all. Maybe the answer is a process change or a piece of education or getting rid of a step or something. I used to run a consulting business and they would find out I did web applications and they had no idea what that meant. I'd be like, oh, well, my company needs a new website. And I'm always like, well, do you? What are you actually trying to do? Are you trying to sell more things or tell a story or whatever? Maybe we should delete your website.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. There's definitely a wisdom, and going back to what we said at the very beginning, knowing where software is the answer versus something else is the answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we're getting close to time here. I'll ask you my last question that I ask everybody, which is, where can people go to learn more about you and Resolve to Save Lives and Simple and everything? And maybe you can also share that you're looking for a Rails developer right now. Maybe tell us briefly a little bit about that role.
Yeah, for sure. So in general, you can go to resolvetosavelives.org to see what my organization's working on. And if you're interested in Simple or the software or the team that is behind it, you can go to simple.org, pretty easy to remember. It's also completely open source. So for the Rails developers or Android developer friends out there that want to dive into the code, feel free, and pull requests are always welcome. And yes, we are hiring. So we have a team of 4 backend engineers, and we're looking to add a 5th. So looking for a relatively senior Rails developer. And I say senior because we're talking about scalability problems. We're at that place where we need to take our app from kind of middle school to high school. It's really mature it. And we need somebody that is pretty well versed in the kind of problems and patterns of problems that a mature Rails app is going to see. So if you can get in touch with me, I'm at Tim Cheadle on Twitter, simple.org. You can link me there. And if you look at our blog, we have a post about the job and the role that we're looking for.
Okay, great. And are you looking for somebody in the US, India, anywhere?
Yeah, so we're looking ideally for somebody East Coast-ish US to kind of UTC plus one, so kind of Europe and West Africa. And that's, we've got plenty of coverage in India. We've got 2 developers, like I said, in the States. And so we're looking for somebody that can ideally bridge all those time zones. So unfortunately, if you live somewhere like San Francisco, it's extremely difficult to make it to all of our meetings. Mm-hmm. So,
got it. Okay. Well, I'll link up all that stuff in the show notes. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I hope it's been interesting for the listener. Tim, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Jason.